Mini episode 475 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 475 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. A very special conversation, a great one that we have for you. One of our favorite guests, I'd say a member of our family at this point. This is our third conversation with him. Our very good friend, former NFL player and author, Vernon Turner. His book, of course, The Next Level, A Game I Had to Play. And it is his memoirs, his very, very, very compelling life story. A little bit of a spoiler alert for the folks who haven't read the book yet, and of course we all haven't seen the movie that that'll be based on. That'll be in the years to come here, but a little bit of a spoiler alert. It all builds to a scene October 2nd, 1994, 20 years ago, and you can find a story commemorating this at Buccaneers.com, the Tampa Bay Bucs. We're nice enough to put up a story on this, recognizing the history that was involved in it. I think it was very smart on their part to do so. The first ever kick or punt return in the history of the franchise. They'd gone 18 years with a drought. Vernon, in his first year with the team and against the Detroit Lions, that meant a lot to him, and we'll talk about that as well. It was a punt return that made history. It went for a touchdown. There were some nice little moves there, the flare when he hit the end zone, which has since become a sort of logo type visage for him. All of this, again, building on what was in the book leading up to that, and again, efforts underway to get this in cinema form in the years to come here. That has been underway, and I understand is making progress, but it is always a pleasure to have back on the show one of my favorite people that we've ever had on, someone who was good enough to put me up in his own home in beautiful Pearland, Texas, an exemplary gentleman, my friend, Vernon Turner. Vernon, welcome back to the show, my friend. Congratulations on the 20th anniversary of the big accomplishment. How are you today?
All right, Rick. Hey, it's great to hear. It's been a while since we've spoken, man. I missed the heck out of you, so this is a really good moment for me today. And thank you for the congratulatory, comments here, because it'll always be a special moment for me, you know. So this is something special.
Well, and again, I touched on it as well. It meant a lot coming off of what had happened for you in the previous 12 to 18 months. Your tenure as a member of the Detroit Lions organization, a 1993 season that was very eventful there, but you got to see firsthand what a lot of people were glimpsing from afar about some of the cracks in the facade of the Wayne Fonts administration. So you had to go through a very, very tough year there. You ended up on the market. Tampa Bay proved to be a very good home for you there with Sam Wyche, but talk about that a little bit too, because it would have been a special moment regardless for you, but there was a little bit of extra oomph to it, a little bit of extra motivation, certainly, and proving yourself to the Detroit Lions in that scenario had to just take that moment right to the stratosphere, I would think.
Well, I'll tell you what, the story in itself in a whole, and I've said this so many times, Rick, and I think you've heard me say this before, and that is, you know, Steven Spielberg could not have written my script in regards to everything that transpired in my life from age 5 until that time that I received that punt from Mr. Montgomery, Greg Montgomery. But stemming back to what you alluded to in regards to being part of the Detroit Lions, yes, it was a tough time. It really was, because, you know, a lot, what people did not realize behind the scenes as far as me personally was that I was fighting tooth and nail to keep my family together. You know, I was really fighting hard to keep a job. You know, it wasn't just a long life dream for me to play professional football. It turned into something that I actually had to do. That's the reason why the name of the book was so fitting, The Next Level, a game that I had to play. It was just of that. I had to play that game, and I felt like there were some situations over in Detroit where they were interfering with that in regards to me keeping my family together, and that's what made it personal to me. You know, I just felt like there were some things going on that, you know, I'm my own worst critic. I think that I'm extremely hard on myself, and if someone beats me outright in something, I'll go over to that individual's hand, and I'll shake it. And I'll say, great job. You're a better man than I am. But when I truly is obvious that I win a job and I still get cut, it's that doesn't sit right. It never sat right with me. And I felt like I was just hopped around like a pinball, like a ping pong ball over there. Just, you know, whenever Mr. Fonts wanted a good relief for Mel Gray, he called me. And the second that Mel Gray got healthy, there were some other guys that they could have relieved him, but he always chose me to get rid of. And I took that personal. So when they released me that last time, and I say within the time that they released me, I'm talking about within maybe 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours, I was picked up by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And the thing of it is that Tampa saw me play. We were in their conference. We played them twice a year, so they knew exactly what they were getting. And I think they knew exactly the extra punch they were getting because they knew what I went through over there. So they knew exactly what they were getting when they signed me. And everything leading up to that moment, to October 2nd, 1994, you know, I've heard it over and over and over again, Rick, in regards to, oh, yeah, VT, you're going to be the first guy ever to do it, and this and that, whatever. And it almost got to a point to where I really got sick of it. I really did, because I refused to add that pressure to me. I just wanted to keep a job to keep my family together. That's all I was really focusing on. But then, you know, with the compound of the events that occurred in Detroit, that just amplified it and magnified it. And by the time I got to game time, I mean, it was something that I can't, it's really tough to describe, because I was always a different type of person on game day anyway. I turned into like a mean, like a little James Cagney. I was a mean cuss. I really was. I was like, the coaches and the players, whoever knew me, knew not to talk to me during game day, because I really turned evil. I didn't like anybody, not my own teammates, no one. And I got in that state, and I got in this mini rage inside. So when I stepped on the field on that day, I knew something was going to happen, because I had no intentions on fair catching not one punt that day. Either I was going to get blown up, fumble, and they released me the next day, or I was going to do something special, because I already had in my mind that I had no intentions on fair catching the ball. Now, my odds were with me because I knew the type of punter that I was going up against. Greg Montgomery is a guy that outkicked his coverage. He kicked it long and deep, which gave me an opportunity to sit underneath the ball and get myself in position to catch. So I was already, the odds were with me. It was just a matter of if I got the right blocks. And you know what? All those guys, I can see it as clear as day. You know, all the blocks that came before me. You know, people said that I showboated before I even hit, before I left the 20-yard line by high-stepping before and after. But I wasn't showboating, man. I was setting up my blocks at the start. And if anyone who saw it, they saw that those guys was just falling down like dominoes. And Mazio Royster got on to Greg Montgomery and blasted him. And that's what freed me up. And, again, it wasn't me, man. It was those blocks. If you saw those blocks on film, they were brutal. They were awesome. So I trust me, I went to every one of my teammates and I thanked them, and I gave them a hug, man, because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't have been in that end zone, you know?
Absolutely. You know, team effort, but you were the guy who successfully pulled the trigger on it. You mentioned a couple of different things there that I found interesting. You talk about getting blown up. There's a great picture in your book. For anybody that hasn't read it yet, The Next Level, a game I had to play, an outstanding picture of one of the preeminent special teams players of all time, your one-time teammate Steve Tasker, absolutely blowing you up on a play, an absolutely vicious hit when you were returning a punt. That's one of the first things I think of when you say that. The other thing is, you were talking about getting moved around there in Detroit sort of like a pinball or a ping pong ball, really kind of apropos because, again, of your frame, and we've talked about this on the show previously, you're the kind of guy that gets described as being a scat back, and in the 90s, you know, we were only really starting to scratch the surface of it. Today in the game, scat backs can be feature backs to a large extent. A lot of the backs in the game that are really doing things out there are of a smaller stature as well, so you were a little bit before your time, but I found it really interesting when I was down there in Texas with you. That was the first time I'd heard about this and seen the YouTube video. The notion that when you came on board in Tampa, I didn't know that it had been a subject of public fascination about this 18-year drought, although I guess if a team had never had something like that, it would be a subject of fascination. But that video that the news did on you that summer, like, could this be the guy to break the long streak that we've never had in Tampa? Absolutely fascinating that that happened, because that year you go on to do it. So it's one of those odd kind of predictions that was put out there, and you ended up living up to it.
Well, Rick, my whole life was a fascinating, and I started using this word. This is a word that I've been using ever since I heard Michael Strahan give his induction speech to the world, and he used the word improbable. Mm-hmm. He used that word, and ever since I heard it, it's fitting. It's very fitting to every aspect of my life, from the time that I decided to play the game of football as a little kid, because I was 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing. But there's a thing that what people, when they looked at me, they said, "Oh my God, this kid's going to get killed." But what they, because they measured me by my stature. But they, one thing, and what carried me from Pee Wee League to the National Football League was that they failed to measure the size of my heart. And as I got older and I got more obsessed and committed to the game, my heart got even bigger and bigger. So when I came down to the National Football League and I got an opportunity there, I knew, no one else knew, but I knew I was going to make it, because I knew that if I didn't make it, my family was gone. So if anybody have ever gone into a situation of a life and death situation, because that's the situation that I was in, they will understand how I felt back then. It's like if you weren't ready to die on a football field, like literally like pass away, like not breathe anymore, if you weren't ready to be in that position, to put yourself in that position, then you weren't going to beat me. There was no way you were going to beat me, because I was ready. I was prepared to die on the football field. And that's the only reason why I made it. It wasn't because I was a great athlete, Rick. It wasn't because I had all these special tools that I worked my tail off to get everything that I got. I thank God I was blessed to have the training regimen of Walter Payton himself gave me his training regimen. And I did it religiously. And the thing of it is was that I pushed my body so far that I probably should have hurt myself severely on some of the things that I was doing. But the thing of it is, at the end of the day, when I got on that football field in the National Football League, they couldn't touch me. They could not touch me, and I was such as in a mentally strong frame in regards to it wasn't a hit that I couldn't take, that I was not going to get up from. And I was listed as probably one of the toughest, back in my era, as one of the toughest little guys in the National Football League. And I hold that proudly. I really do. Because being tough, that's three-quarters of the game of football. It's a physical game. If you're not ready to take the hits and laugh at them after they hit you, you can't play the game. So now that I see the game the way it is now, how I hate to use this term, but I got to keep it real. They have officially wussified the league in regards to some of these things. You cannot touch the quarterback. Wide receivers, they don't care about going across the middle anymore. You can't touch them. You can't hit them. So they have wussified the league in some sense. But, you know, again, I still love the game. I respect it, and I enjoy it. And I've been blessed. I've been blessed to be able to take this game and use it after I left the game. You know, I'm taking it and I'm paying it forward now. And that's the key now for me, is to share my story, because if I can make it, Rick, anybody can make it. That's how I see it.
Absolutely. And there's two different things you said there that I want to follow up on. I want to get your thoughts on the direction of the game, because it's sort of been at a crossroads the last couple of years in some of the ways that you mentioned there. But what I first want to do is follow up as far as your life story that we've been talking about a little bit. And, of course, again, I'm going to refer everybody back to the first two appearances that you had on the show here. People should check those out to hear it in great detail. But a little bit of an encapsulated thing here for people who haven't yet checked those out or read your book yet. Again, you alluded to the struggle to make it to the NFL. Of course, the subtitle of your book, A Game I Had to Play, and that's something we've talked about previously. A lot of people grow up with having the dream to play. You are one of the rare cases out there, one of the very, very rare cases of somebody who was born into a lot of childhood difficulty, and a lot of people, when that's the case, oh, the NFL will be my way out. You are the guy that actually did that. You were the one in a million, maybe one in a billion, where you had to do that. That was your lifeline out of a tough life. You talked about holding your family together. Of course, even the minimum salaries 20 to 25 years ago are not what they are today, so you needed to be in the league for at least a couple of years to kind of get that scratch together. So there's all of this, of course, that went into it, but I'd like to have you just kind of describe that a little bit in your own words, that very tough, very perilous journey that you had to the league with everything that was at stake for you.
I think you hit it on the head, too. It was pretty much a million-to-one odds. It was some improbable odds that I went through. I mean, we're starting from age five when I was born, you know, born and raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. You know, at the time, it was just myself and my brother and my mom, and we all lived, the three of us lived in my grandmother's house, along with a bunch of other cousins that I had. It was my home. It was the only thing that I knew. But if anyone knew about Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, it was predominantly African American. It was predominantly black, about 98%, 99% pretty much. So that's all that I knew, you know. So, but to make sure people understand the circumstances that I was in, you know, at the time, even at 5 years old, you know, my mom was out in the streets. She was using drugs. She was prostituting. She was really, you know, she had down spiraled, really, really bad, really down spiraled. And it was a tough gig for her, you know, because at one point she was a hell of an athlete. She was a track runner, you know. She was active. She was an athlete, and she down spiraled. So while she's out in the street, and this is the part that people can't get a grasp on, and they think that this is fake. It was made up. It was embellished. My mom's out there working the street as a prostitute, and I have to say these things to make sure there's no gray area when I say these things and people understand it, and I don't want them wondering what did he mean by that. I'm just gonna keep it real here. My mom was out prostituting, selling her body, you know, out in the street, and she comes across this one man, you know, a white guy from Staten Island, New York, and I don't know exactly what happened, but for some reason, my mom captivated this man, and he saw something in this woman more than just someone that he's buying, okay? He saw something more than that. So make a long story short in regards to that aspect, he asked her to move into his house in Staten Island, New York. Now, understand this. Now, my stepdad, I don't even like calling him that anymore. He's my dad. My dad, I didn't realize how incredible of a man he was until after the fact, until I actually started writing the book, when I realized how incredible this man was. Think about this scenario. You're talking about a full-fledged Italian back in the early 70s, all right, take three people of a different race, black. One of them is a prostitute selling her body, taking drugs. He takes them and moves them into his house, his suburb area, all white. Now, I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know what it was, but it was something that it takes a special individual. It takes a special strength to do that, okay? So he did that. Now, my whole life has changed within 2 weeks of her meeting him, 2 weeks. And I didn't find out. I found out within 4 days before we moved that we were moving. And I thought she was just joking. I didn't know until we left. So I was abruptly moved. So it took some years to get used to the change of going to an all-black to an all predominantly all-white environment now, you know. And, you know, back then we had some more exposed issues in regards to race than we do now. Right now it's a little bit more in a closet now. It's hidden now more than it was before. So I had my really major issues in regards to being called the N-word and scribbled N-word, go home, on my driveway. It was a hot mess back then, man. It was tough. So I had to get acclimated to that, in addition to my mom still taking drugs. Now, as a kid, as I grew up, you know, some years come on, my dad introduced me to the game of football at age 10. I fell in love with the game of football because I went to my first game, my first New York Jets game. And I saw, you know, Emmitt Boozer and Joe Namath and those guys play, and I was just – that was when I decided I want to be a professional football player. In addition to, I fell in love with the actual team of the Chicago Bears because of Walter Sweetness Payton. That man was my everything, and he still is for what he stood for. So, you know, with my mom taking drugs, still on the drugs, she didn't prostitute anymore, but she was taking drugs. And my mom and dad used to fight all the time, all the time. Like, they used to go at it, fighting. And, of course, I took my mom's side because I was still in that resentment mode towards white, you know, the white guy, you know, take me away from my black family. I was in that mode. So I always sided with my mom. I didn't understand what those fights were until years later I found out what those fights were all about. But my mom was always going to Brooklyn to go get her drugs and visit the family, whole nine, and I had to be babysitting because from the time that we moved, my mom started reproducing pretty quick. She ended up reproducing three more kids, my sister Charlene, my brother Brian, and my sister Ellen. So it was a total of five of us. And guess what? The oldest had to babysit all the time. Not only did I have to babysit, I had to braid hair, cook dinners, change diapers, cook and clean house. So I was the actual caregiver, you know, since age nine. So that's all that I knew. And what little time I got a chance to go out and play and hang out with my friends, I tried to do that. But it was that one game that enabled me to forget what was going on at home, and that was the game of football. And as the years went on, I fell in love with that game. And the more I fell in love with it, the more my mom realized it, and she used it against me. And this is another lesson that I learned years ago, Rick, was that you take care of home first. You make sure your house is taken care of, your family's taken care of before you go out and do your thing. And my mom was indicative of that even while she was doing her drugs. She did what she had to do, what she felt she had to do. She did her drugs. She did whatever she did. But guess what? We never went without food. We never went without a roof over our head. And we always were taken care of because she took care of us first before she went out in the street. And in a sense, she tried to teach me the same way, that you're not going to have football if you don't take care of your chores or your brothers or your sisters. You're not going to have those things. So, but I didn't know that at the time, Rick. I was a kid. It didn't register to me. So all I thought about was that she was keeping me from the sport that I love. So I started resenting my mother. I started wishing her dead. I started doing all these things as far as I started actually hating my mother. Because I, you know, as the years went on, 13, 14 years old, I started wishing her dead. Until, you know, the end of my freshman year, she grounded me from off-season workout program. I was a kid, and this was weird too, I was a kid that was infatuated with practice. I absolutely loved practice. To me, that was a game. So I was that obsessed with the game. And, again, my mom knew that. She would ground me from practices. Or with other kids, would probably be like, oh, yeah, thanks, Mom. But, no, I was really obsessed with this game. This one particular time she did it, and I ran in my room, man, and I went on my knees, and I prayed that this woman would go. And within 72 hours, my mom was gone. She was dead. She, you know, there was a pneumonia, double pneumonia, and the drugs killed her. But the timing of that, Rick, the timing of that, I will never forgive myself for. This is the first time that I'm actually talking about it without breaking, because that's something that I'm going to carry with for the rest of my life because of the timing. I wish this woman, I went on my knees, I put my hands together, and I prayed to God that this woman would die. 72 hours later, my mother was dead. So I don't care what anybody tells me, okay? I don't care how many therapists try to get in my head and make me realize whatever they want me to realize. The end of the day is that I will never forgive myself for doing that. So in that instance, because, you see, what people don't understand also is that, you know, there was another event in my mom's life that she made an ultimate sacrifice for, because when she was 18 years old, she was brutally raped. She was by three guys, and they were going to throw her off a roof, okay? And they didn't. But through the grace of God, they didn't throw her off that roof. 2 weeks later, my mom finds out she's pregnant, and it's a shame for me to admit, I'm a product of that. I'm a product of that. And she told me that when I was when I was 11 years old, she told me that story. And for many years, I felt like trash, Rick. I felt like total trash for many years. I had very low self-esteem. Okay, so I had to battle through that as well. But, you know, when I move up forward now, and I'm burying my mother, and when I'm at that gravesite, and before they put in that dirt, I got to sit in front of her and talk to her. And tell her I didn't mean it. I didn't tell her. I had to tell her that I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to wish her dead. And I thanked her for giving me life, because she could have easily aborted me. She could have easily given me up for adoption. But that woman kept me. And that's what makes this hurt that much more. Because of that. Because of that the sacrifices that woman made for me. And I turn around and I do what I did. And I'll never forgive myself for that. So my mission now is to make sure this story gets out and make sure people understand how incredible this woman was and how incredible my dad was for taking her out of that environment and just loving this woman, just loving her. Because all those fights were about, Rick, it was about getting her off the damn drugs. That's what that was about. And I never knew it.
Yes.
Okay? I never knew it. So you got two incredible people that has to be honored at the highest level, and I'm talking global. And that's it. I'm not gonna rest until this project reach global status, because it is that powerful and it is that important to me. And I know that it has the ability to change and save lives. That's the only reason why I'm not doing this for money. I'm not doing this for publicity or status. I can't give a damn about any of that crap. My thing is that I want my family, my parents honored, and I want these kids out there to understand that they only have one set of parents. They only have one set of guardians, and they can be gone in a blink of an eye if they're not careful. So you make sure you tell them you love them just because I left with both my parents. I left while I fought with both of them before they died, and I got to live with that. So now my thing is that I don't want anyone else living like that. Even my enemies, I don't really have too many of those. But the people that I don't like, I don't want anyone going through what I'm going through right now, man. It's like a walk in hell. It really is. So I tried to get through this whole segment without breaking, Rick. I almost made it. But I think the point is gotten across on how important this project is to me.
My story with my mom is not quite the same as that. I understand that it can be hard to get through something without breaking down. And at worst you were right on the border there. I think you came through that explanation fine. I will say too, talk about the things that could be taken out of context quite easily. I was glad when you went full circle on that story that you mentioned about the rape, because that puts everything into perspective. Obviously, that's why your mom self-medicated, went into the spiral, whatever. It all stemmed from the trauma of that and what she went through. And again, as you pointed out, a person of exceptional strength, much like your father. You know, you also had, and this gets highlighted in the book as well, other guardian angels around you at the high school and college levels who helped keep the dream alive. So it seems to me also, too, in terms of your determination to put this out there right now, it seems like it's a good counterpoint for everybody in terms of all the negativity right now, because we're hearing about all the a-holes of the NFL, you know, beating their wives, beating their kids, whatever. This has been a low ebb, you know, in the NFL for bad publicity about a lot of the troublemakers in the last couple of weeks here. You know, it seems like this is the kind of story that provides that kind of counterbalance out there about the silent majority of guys who, you know, have a better story to tell, it seems like.
Well, I'll tell you what, here's the surprise of all surprises. Guess what? All of this stuff that's happening, that's being exposed now in the National Football League and any other sport, that's been happening. It's been happening all along. The problem, the thing of it is now, social media has gotten so huge and so big, it's exposed now more than ever, okay? Those things have happened. It's been happening. The thing of it, again, now social media has gotten a hold of it. You got your Twitter, you got your Facebook, you got your Instagram. You got all these mechanisms of social media, and it's blown up. And you know what? Good. I'm glad it did, because maybe it'll save some of these people. Maybe it'll save some of these families. Maybe it'll save some of these kids that are, you know, getting abused, and these women that are getting abused. Maybe it'll save them now. Now maybe these guys will say, "Hey, I can't do that anymore. You know, it's gonna hit the papers. It's gonna hit the wire." Maybe it takes something like that for them to quit beating up on people and doing the wrong things. Maybe it does. I'm glad it did. But the thing of it is, it's been happening all along. It's not like all of a sudden guys woke up, "Oh, I think I'm going to, you know, beat my kids or beat my wife or assault somebody."
Right.
That wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. It's just now it's being exposed now. That's what it is. And I'm glad that it is being exposed.
Yes, absolutely, you know? Because it's a better game with that kind of stuff out of there. It's a better product for society, no question about it. And we were talking about this a little bit before, the whole notion of some of the other changes that have been coming to the league in recent years as a result of some things getting highlighted. And I know that, again, we talked about, you know, you getting lit up by Steve Tasker before there. And, of course, that is emblematic of, you know, discussions that have been had in the last couple of years about CTE, the concussion issue, long-term brain trauma. We've seen a lot of guys, you know, getting trotted out on TV, somebody like Jim McMahon, who can't really remember what happened 10 minutes ago, unfortunately, and a lot of the guys out there. So they've been making a lot of efforts, it seems like. I mean, I would get the sense from the outside, you know, the heart's in the right place, I think, as far as, you know, wanting to make sure that everybody leaves the game hopefully as good as you, because to my knowledge, you're not really carrying around any ill effects, unless I'm wrong. But, you know, you seem to be a guy who got out of it pretty good. They'd obviously like to have a lot more success stories like that. But what do you think about the balance that, you know, needs to be struck in terms of doing that and protecting what you clearly see as the integrity of the game?
Well, I think they're between a rock and a hard place. They're walking a fine line from – I understand they need to protect these guys. They need to protect the players. And – It's a different type of game than it was before. I think it's more or less of a harder hitting game. I have to admit that, because the guys are bigger, stronger, and faster now. You know, these guys are, you know, you're 6'6", 6'7", 290, 280, 290, and they're running under 4'5". You know, that's unheard of. That's freakish of nature, in a sense. But at the same time, you know, this is a combative sport. You know, this is a sport that, you know, you can really do some bodily harm. You can actually kill somebody on a football field, you know, if you hit them hard enough or hit them a certain way. And I understand the concern because, yeah, when you hear about these stories with the, you know, Jim McMahons and all these guys that are really having a hard time, you know, you don't want to hear that. That's the part that you don't want to hear. But it is the nature of this beast. You know, it's the nature of the game. It's a combative sport. I mean, when you sign on a dotted line, when you sign your contract, there are things that tells you that you can actually get killed. I mean, you can do bodily harm. And guess what? We still sign on that dotted line. And I bet you any amount of money that if you ask any of those guys that have chronic issues right now, if you had a chance to turn back the clock and actually get to the point to where you can sign your contract before you even play, would you still sign that contract? And I would say 99.9% of those guys, if not 100, would say yes, I would have signed that contract again. Because we know going in what the results can turn out. Who would think that it would happen? It's not going to happen to me. We get in that mode. That's not going to happen to me. But, you know, again, the nature of the beast of this game is for the defense to knock the snot out of an offensive ball player. That is their job, is to knock the ball loose and knock those guys as hard as they possibly can. The objective for the offense is not to be hit and to score as many points as you possibly can. Now, it's like two Rams. You're going to get some contact. Now, the thing of it is now, and it's cool that what they're doing is that they're focusing on, okay, where do you hit an individual? Okay, where do you place your helmet? Where do you make sure you hit with your shoulder pads. Don't lead with your head. I mean, those are the things that we should have been taught a long time ago, but when the game moves as fast as it does, it's really difficult sometimes to hit that target the way where you're actually aiming, but you don't actually hit it because people are moving so doggone fast. And that's the part that I get frustrated at, because when you're flying in the air and you intentionally trying to go and you hit with your shoulder, but people are moving so fast, you hit them inadvertently with your helmet. Next thing you know, they're taking $10,000 and $15,000, $25,000 away from guys. I struggle with that part. But you know, they got to figure out a way to protect these guys, and they just got to be careful, because next thing you know, they'll just be putting flags on all the players' hips and turn it into a professional flag football league. You know, you just got to be careful.
Well, that's a perspective that really means a lot coming from you, because, again, as a small guy who made his predominant impact on special teams, I mean, there are a few more vulnerable places in all of sports than being a smaller guy running back a punt or even a kickoff, I guess, and having these guys flying at you. So your perspective on that is worth more than the rest of ours combined, I'd say, because we're just theorizing about something we haven't done. You've done it. You've been out there on Sundays and experienced it. And, again, it's like you said, it's very, very difficult to strike the right balance. Hopefully they're going to be getting closer to doing that in the time ahead. And, again, I know that, you know, your perspectives on all of these things, you know, your life story, the game as it stands up today, of course, all of that can be found at VernonTurner.com, and that is a good hub for people to continue to go to and be able to access the book, The Next Level, A Game I Had to Play. So, again, what are some of the things that are ahead in the near future for you, my man?
Well, I really can't get into all the main specifics, but just like what you alluded to, there are some activity happening in regards to a potential featured film, hopefully. There are some players that are out there that we're talking to, and it's a process. I realize that it's a major process. Drawn out process, but I can actually, for the first time since thinking about taking the project to that level, this is the first time I'm actually seeing some type of a light at the end of the tunnel. So I'm hoping probably by the start of the new year I can make a major announcement. You know, if things keep progressing the way they have been, I can make an announcement via all the medias, the social medias. Of the next level, going to the next level. So, I'm excited about it. The process is even though it's drawn out and it's in this long drawn process, it's an unbelievable experience. The people that I'm speaking with, is priceless. I know I'll get an opportunity to be a huge part of the project once it comes into fruition. And it's another part of the journey that hopefully I can actually, you know, get the type of exposure that I want to get out, you know, and that is to make sure that I pay everything that I've gotten to me, pay it to the next person. So now I'm excited. I really am. The V team, we're just getting everything prepped and putting it in the right components. So once we do, you know. Break out and break release, of the main project. It's going to be in a position to where I can just sit back and just, you know, just exhale for the first time, man. I tell you, I'm exhausted. I really am, because I'm nonstop. But I'm not going to rest until we get this project at the global status that it deserves to be. Because I love and I respect all those guys, Michael Orr, you know, and The Blind Side, Rudy Whitaker, the Rudy, Vince Papale, you know, Invincible, all those guys that have these stories, these unbelievable, incredible stories. I think my story is pretty comparable, if not got a little bit more. I don't know. I just think that we have the ability to change and save lives. At the end of the day, we have the ability to change and save lives. So I'm looking forward to that, Rick. I really am.
Absolutely. You know, and don't forget Keanu Reeves from The Replacements. Oh, wait a minute. That was fictional. Never mind. My bad. But, you know, your story is right there in the pantheon, my friend. And, again, I can tell you, too, from the little bit of stuff I've done, I can attest to what you're saying about H. Wood. And even when you got a winner, you're just banging your head on the wall until you finally break through on it. But, you know, as far as this thing getting made into a movie, you know, fittingly enough, with you being a football player, you know, I'll give you the Bart Scott voice. Can't wait! Can't wait! It will happen, and we will be right there supporting it in the FDH Lounge. As I say, you're one of the best friends of the show out there. Just always rooting for the best for you, and we'll continue to keep up with stuff with you on the show as things go along. And when you are announcing stuff, I know that we will be right there on your announcement tour. So looking forward to that, Vernon. Again, thank you for everything, for being such a good friend of the program. Best of luck with everything. God bless, and we are supporting you as strong as we can.
Ricky, thank you so much. And each passing time, you're becoming a dear friend. You know, and Steve Savillo, and you guys are awesome. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate it, Vernon, and it's an honor to be able to spotlight a great story like yours. God bless with everything, and again, no question about it, making your parents proud with everything that you're doing. Thanks so much for being here on the program today. Thank you all, everyone, for joining us today and listening on the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.